It doesn't look like it's going to be the case.
Oh, I'm shedding a tear already. Claire Nisley, thank you. Meteorologist, thank you very much. Well, look, whether it's snowy or not, we at Times Radio hope you have a very Merry Christmas, and there's only one person who can express that in a little phrase. Tiny Tim.
God bless us, everyone.
Thank you. I'm just weeping here. Anyway, that is it from me today, and I'm sure you're glad about that. I've had the pleasure of hosting the last Times at One before the Christmas break from Andrew and Stephen and Joe and who else is Danny, and of course our boss Jeremy Griffin, who stepped in one time. Have a great Christmas. The fun is going to carry on for you. Ayesha Hazarika is here tomorrow from 1 o'clock, and right now, up next on Times Radio, Rosie Wright and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Trevor, thank you very much. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You are listening to Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio.
And coming up on our programme today, can teaching schoolboys about misogyny and consent help to tackle violence against women? We're going to talk to the feminist campaigner Julie Bindle about that one. It is Take Out the Trash Day, when the government tries to slip all the bad news out in a rush just as Parliament goes home for Christmas. We will sift through the results for you. As a man who tried to kill Donald Trump is sentenced, we'll ask just how you could ever protect a president and who ate all the pies. We're going to be live in Wigan for the World Pie Eating Championships results.
But first, let's get the latest news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Rosie. Thank you. The Bank of England has cut interest rates to the lowest level since early 2023. Times Radio's Emma Smith has the details.
It's reducing its base rate of interest to 3.75%. The move had been widely expected, especially after yesterday's bigger-than-expected cut in inflation. The Chancellor's welcomed it, but said there's more to do to help families.
The bank is forecasting inflation will fall to close to its 2% target. However, the Conservatives say prices have been kept higher through government policy, like rises to national insurance. Flu cases have continued to rise to record levels for December. An average of 3,140 flu patients were in hospital in England each day last week, up 18% on the week before. That growth rate is slower than earlier in December. The government is preparing to postpone local elections for a second year for millions of people. Ministers will ask Conservative-controlled county councils whether they want to suspend elections until 2027. It's because local leaders have asked for more time to implement reforms abolishing the two-tier county and district council system, but it is likely to provoke a backlash from the Liberal Democrats and Reform UK. Police chiefs are under pressure to follow forces in London and Manchester, which will now arrest people who chant "Globalise the Intifada." Politicians from both Labour and the Conservatives say the chants can be linked to anti-Semitic attacks like on Bondi Beach over the weekend. Two people were arrested in central London last night for using the word Intifada at a pro-Palestinian protest. The Prime Minister says the government's new plan to teach boys as young as 11 about combating misogyny is intentionally targeting younger children.
The age at which individuals are in abusive relationships sometimes, or being abused or subjected to violence, is going down, not up. And therefore, yes, I want to strengthen what we do when we actually are able to prosecute cases, but I absolutely want to get in at the very early stage.
The strategy puts more emphasis on teachers and parents to teach teenagers about healthy relationships and how to stop misogyny in order to reduce violence against women and girls. However, some, like the Children's Commissioner in England, are arguing the focus should be on providing positive experiences and role models for boys instead. Actors have paved the way to strike over artificial intelligence. The union, Equity, says members have voted overwhelmingly in an indicative ballot, saying they're prepared to refuse to be scanned digitally on set. It would need a further ballot to officially take industrial action, but General Secretary Paul Fleming says it's a groundbreaking move.
AI is a generation-defining challenge, which Equity members are prepared to meet with generation-defining industrial action. Not in my lifetime has Equity felt compelled to begin the process to obtain a mandate for industrial action in this sector.
Mr. Fleming's calling on producers to return to negotiations. And estate agents say a weak housing market has led to what they call a staggering rise in people reducing their bids after having an offer accepted. Hamptons says 10% of deals are subject to what is nicknamed gazundering, the opposite of gazumping, but it says that can rise to as much as 90% in the most expensive areas. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
And a very good afternoon here. Cheers all round. You have joined us for the end of term. And there is sort of a bit of an end of term feeling. Fee Glover and Rosie right here for the last official programme of the year. Next week in this time slot, Count Binface will be here keeping you company. So it is the last programme like this of 2025. But aha! The Christmas holidays hasn't come soon enough for the government. We are going to start the show by rifling through the huge number of announcements that they've dumped today, hoping that all the journalists will already have gone home and won't have been bothered to read them. Not here. If it's the cost of the COVID inquiry or court backlogs at another record high, we will pour through the detail that was meant for the dustbin. Will sending teenage boys, even boys as young as 11, on misogyny courses help that generation stamp out violence against women and girls? The women's rights campaigner Julie Bindle will join us in an hour. The former US Security Service agent Barry DiNardio will tell us how you protect a president. He used to be tasked with protecting Obama and Bush. If your family or your office may have been hit with absences from flu, we'll see if hospital admissions may finally now be at a peak. Jane Mulkerens is going to flick through this weekend's magazine with us, including an eye-watering dress popping feature on how even the fashion editors of our most glossy magazines sometimes fall foul really of some of the worst embarrassing wardrobe malfunctions. And when I say the worst, think underwear on display at Buckingham Palace. Never ideal. And contestants in Wigan will try today to inhale a pie faster than the world record of 14.9 seconds.
It's quite a record, isn't it?
It is.
I once ran across a very, very packed playground at my kids' primary school to go and to give something important to somebody important without realising that a pair of my pants had fallen out of the bottom of my jeans. And do you know what? It's embarrassing enough for kids to even have parents when they're in primary school, let alone for your mother to do that. Chris McCausland is our guest after 3:30 this afternoon. He's such a funny man. He's also an incredibly clever man. It is astonishing to think that as a blind person, he won Strictly Come Dancing. And after he won Strictly, he could do whatever he wanted in terms of TV. So the BBC literally said to him, Chris, what would you like to do next? And he chose to make a documentary about how cutting-edge AI and technology has completely transformed his life. So if you think of all of the wearable tech that we might see as simply enhancing our life or being a bit of a kind of show-offy thing that we might like to wear at the moment, tells us stuff about our heartbeats and our sleep and all of that. For Chris, it means that he has somebody that he can ask about the world around him all the time. So he's made this incredible documentary about the new technology coming out of Silicon Valley and MIT that is helping him as a blind person. So we'll talk to him after 3:30. I really recommend that you try and have a listen to this one because he's absolutely superb about the trajectory of tech and how it is mirroring everything that went before. So the resistance to the printing press way back when, he says, is exactly the same kind of feeling of resistance that we have to AI at the moment. So maybe we should just check in with ourselves about the march of progress.
Should we look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon?
Rosie Wright, it's a very good idea. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number three, Trump's White House plaque declares Joe Biden worst president. The US leader's Walk of Fame takes aim at the sleepy former president and Barack Obama. Portraits of Mr. Trump's Democrat rivals now have inscriptions below them written with his trademark capitals and exclamation marks. The second most read story, A Guide to K-Pop Demon Hunters by our eight-year-old expert. This is in our top three for the second day running. It's the lowdown on Netflix's biggest ever film by someone who really knows. And that just means that thousands of parents have seen that article and thought, yep, I need to know a little bit more. The most read piece on the Times website, though, is Coldplay Kiss Cam HR Boss. That's Kristen Cabot on 16 Seconds That Ruined Her Life. The former astronomer executive is speaking publicly for the first time. She tells the Times about her panic after seeing the video, the impact on her children and the danger of the online mob. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Why not ask for one for Christmas? Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
It's 9 minutes past two. Now, it's the last day before Parliament goes into recess. It's also known as Take Out the Trash Day. A day in which the government tries to bury bad news and rush out embarrassing stories without the pain of having to face up to scrutiny from opponents or the media. So let's discuss what the government's been up to with Alan Tolhurst, chief reporter at Politics at Home. Alan, a very good afternoon to you. We've had a flurry of announcements actually already earlier this week and many more today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is the traditional taking out the trash day, as it is referred to. Essentially, lots of kind of written ministerial statements and also a huge number of kind of these like transparency releases. Back in the David Cameron government, they kind of agreed to publish things like meetings of ministers with lobbyists and all this kind of stuff. And essentially, they realised that actually, if you just put them all out in one big go, it's impossible for people like me to look through all of them. And they might get one or two bad stories in tomorrow's paper, but instead of dripping them out individually, they'd have hundreds of potentially bad stories. So it's a way of kind of masking a lot of stuff by putting everything out. So yeah, an awful lot of kind of stuff to comb through myself, and the lobby journalists haven't clocked off for Christmas yet. I've had our work cut out this morning.
Absolutely. So tell us what you've found already.
Well, interestingly, I always think that the most interesting ones often have the most banal titles. That's always the way you kind of hide it the most, if you give it just a very kind of blank sort of title, essentially. So there was one that popped out for me last night. It was from the Prime Minister and it was just called Machinery of Government. So I immediately made a beeline for that one, thinking that could be quite interesting. Turns out it's just about kind of moving the responsibility for the severe space weather stuff from one department to another. But actually, one of the interesting ones is Minette Batters, Baroness Batters, who's chairman of the National Farmers Union, her report into kind of the viability of farming going forward, which a lot of people have been waiting for. That was kind of slipped out quietly this morning. And although it wasn't part of her remit in the review to look at the changes to inheritance tax that this government brought in, that of course a lot of uproar amongst farmers, she said that was the thing that people spoke to her the most about. And then a lot of farmers have been left bewildered and frightened. And there's now going to be further pressure, I think, on the government to reverse those changes on inheritance tax for agricultural land as a result of this. And one of the ones that's come through the troubled kind of Ajax armored vehicle program that had been paused. The Defence Secretary has now said that pausing all trials is going to continue after another person was found to experience kind of symptoms after the vibrations of those kind of through. So another kind of continued kind of troubled for that kind of the really kind of terrible kind of defence procurement policy that's been going on.
Yeah, I think terrible is the word. So these Ajax armored vehicles, the vibrations and noise left the people who were using them sort of shaking and vomiting. Billions has been spent on the programme. It seems to be a monumental waste of money so far.
Yeah, and I think it's been known about for a long time. You know, there was, the initial contract was signed, I think, in about 2010. They were meant to start production in 2014, be in service by the end of the last decade. And actually, still only about 150 odd of the 600 that were ordered have been built. And every time they're brought into service or brought into trial, they eventually have to be pulled because of this issue over vibrations that, yeah, the soldiers report kind of vomiting, being shaking. Some have had potentially, lifelong hearing. hearing loss as a result. And what's kind of interesting is the way that the army has reacted. They've often said that, oh, there's just some tweaks to be done, and actually this project can be kind of salvaged. And successive governments have continued to move this project forward. And it does feel as though at some point someone's going to have to pull the plug. But so much money has been spent on this. It's kind of a classic example of the kind of the difficulties around defence procurement and kind of the way these costs kind of spiral, because all it managed to do is make lots of vehicles which are completely unusable.
Yeah, the thing I was keen to sort of search through in the numerous press releases today was that the Crown Court backlog, because we get figures four times a year, and those figures came out today as well, just published a few hours ago, about the court backlog in England and Wales. It has hit another new record. How much does this play then into David Lammy's plans to review juries, to put in some policies pretty sharpish to make sure, you know, in 3 months' time that number eventually starts to come down?
Yeah, what's kind of interesting, I suppose, that number, the backlog has been going up every time it's been released since 2023. It has continued every time it comes out. It is a new record. But I think what's so interesting is that figure that came out today is that the backlog in magistrates court is up 17% up to 373,000. And part of the problem that the government is going to have is they want to move people away from the jury trials to having these offences which are known as each way. They can either be done by magistrates or by Crown Court, to just be done by magistrates, not have a jury trial. You know, moving stuff away from jury trial is not as easy as it first looks, because there is a massive backlog at the lower end as well. So it's going to be even more difficult, I think, for that to happen. So yes, it might take some pressure off the Crown Courts, but it'll only simply put further pressure on Magistrates Court. And anyone who's been to Magistrates Court over the past 10 years know kind of how chaotic and kind of under-resourced they are as well. So yes, it might help in one side, but actually unless that investment goes into the magistrate side, you're just going to end up with a further kind of backlog, further kind of squeezing of things at the lower end as well.
How strong has the backlash been to David Lammy's plans to completely overhaul really how our justice system finds people guilty or innocent?
Yeah, well, we're seeing a kind of a rebellion. It wasn't kind of necessarily expected. We thought some people would kind of grumble about it. We have seen lots of MPs going over the top. Carl Turner, a Labour MP, who's been pretty loyal. He's never rebelled in his whole time as an MP against his party's whip. He's saying that he will rebel on this. And he's organised around 40 of his fellow MPs to sign a letter saying that the government should back down on this. So it's one of those things where perhaps it wasn't expected. It was going to be controversial. I don't necessarily think the government felt that it was going to have this much internal pressure. But I think as we head into the new year, those numbers could increase as MPs go back over Christmas and speak to their constituents. They could come back with some renewed vigour. And I think as well, that kind of undercurrent of unhappiness that a lot of MPs feel probably will push them perhaps towards rebelling, when perhaps they might not have done if things were going well. So I think this government has got a long way to go to convince not only kind of the public that scrapping jury trials is the right thing to do, but also convincing its own internal critics and its own MPs as well.
There's so much, because that is, I guess, the purpose of this, to sort of absolutely send so many press releases out. There was something about the cost of the COVID inquiry, millions being spent on staffing in the last quarter.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there's another one. And there's also one about into the inquiry into Manston base where lots of migrants were housed and kind of deaths that happened there. The kind of inquiry. There's something also into kind of consultation on results of the inquiry into the Manchester Arena bombing around kind of private security. But yeah, a classic one is putting out figures around spending for things that people aren't too keen on is a big one. So yeah, we've just seen the Q2 figures for the COVID inquiry. I think pushed it up for this financial year to 9.3 million, I think, with the legal costs at 6 million on top of that. So yeah, an awfully large amount of money for not a great deal to be seen for it at the moment. But yeah, that's a classic of the genre, pushing out something like that.
Yeah, what are some of the biggest stories historically then that governments have tried to bury using this strategy?
Well, I think one of them actually has definitely been around meetings with people. I think because often ministers who end up taking meetings with perhaps with senior people in the media and elsewhere, or they often try and hide those. But because they do come out, because people like myself are looking for those, you do get to kind of a real insight into who senior politicians are meeting outside of politics. And so that's definitely one that has definitely played a long time. And I think also as well, things like gifts and overseas trips, we've even seen this week, the cost of, I think, of Keir Starmer's trip to go and see the Lionesses play last summer, the cost of that, and obviously what the cost might be if he has to go and if he goes to see some of the World Cup matches next summer. So I think that kind of stuff is often often a good one to pull out. It's often a nice one to have in that kind of Christmas period when there's not much else to write about. So there's lots of stuff to be used there.
Alan, thank you very much for sifting through it. I know you're doing that anyway for your day job, but particularly to make sure we are absolutely peppered full of stories. Alan Tolhurst, chief reporter at Politics Home.
Suzanne has just texted in to say, in my next life, I'm going to be a lawyer advising or in government, ka-ching. And Tom has texted in to say, oh, Fee's going to talk to a feminist about misogyny. She must be so pleased. Well, I am. It's a really important topic, Tom. I had you down as a better man than that. Why don't you let me know what you'd do about the epidemic of violence against women and girls, and I'll pop it into the conversation. Who ate all the pies? That's what we're going to talk about next. We're going to hear from a newly minted world champion. It's 18 minutes past two. Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Jeff Norcott on Times Radio.
I'm Jeff Norcott, and every Friday night I'm joined by some of my comedy friends to find the funny in the week's news, as well as a review of all the latest from Westminster, Washington and beyond. We're pulling out all the stops with our showbiz contacts. There's cultural conversation from best-selling authors and business leaders, plus hard recommendations and show-stopping music to kickstart your weekend. All that and more on Friday Night with Norcott.
Jeff Norcott, tomorrow night from 7 on Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Now, together with Wickes, we'd like to know your proudest moment of the week to be in with a chance to win a £250, 250 quid Wickes voucher in our Wickes Peacock Awards. All you have to do is just send us a very brief line about why you are proud of someone, why you are proud of yourself. Bear in mind it's Christmas and we're quite baubly, aren't we, today?
Absolutely.
Shiny baubly, stars on top of the tree, eaten too many chocolates already. We're looking for maybe that kind of a vibe. We've got lots of suggestions so far. We'll do the winner just before 4 o'clock. Have you got some contenders, Rosie?
Yes, Helen has nominated her daughter Eve to be as proud as a peacock because she's recently passed her psychology master's degree with distinction. Helen says, I am so proud of her. Well, I'm sure you absolutely are. And Kyra says, I'm feeling proud. I've just had an offer accepted on a property. I'm excited, but it's a little bit daunting. It's the first time I've lived on my own and I've got a lot of improvements to do.
I'm going to pop into the mix Susan Johnson, Lauren Fox, Emma, Chris Evans, Lisa, not that Chris Evans, I don't think, and Tilly as well. You're all going to go into our nominations box and we'll take a jolly, jolly good look through everybody else's contentions and we will decide on the winner at 4 o'clock. So you can send us a WhatsApp, 0333 003 2353, or you can email us, Jane and Fee at times.radio. Now, for the few of you out there who don't already know, today is the annual World Pie Eating Championship. The competition has been held at Harry's Bar in Wigan for decades. Last year's winner set a record of pie consumption by inhaling an entire one in just 14.9 seconds. Now, a twist in orderly proceedings this year saw a ramping up of surveillance after rumours that some contestants were planning an elaborate way to cheat the competition. It's broken Britain. Tony Callahan is the owner of Harry's Bar, and we're also joined by this year's winner, Tom O'Neill. Gentlemen, very good afternoon. Welcome to Times Radio.
Hi, are you okay?
Yeah, very well indeed. Now, which one's which? Tony, can you identify yourself by telling us how the competition works?
Yeah, basically, it's eat a pie as quickly as possible. And when you've got an empty mouth, that's the winner.
Okay. What type of pie? How big's the pie? Sweet or savoury? Who's choosing the pie?
It's a meat and potato pie.
Yeah.
And it's a regulatory size, which is about 12 centimetres in depth by 3.5 centimetres, and it goes from 0 to 15 degrees. So we're particular on the pie.
How hot is the pie?
It's just warm. Because I can't have anybody burning the throat, so I give them a piping hot pie.
Now, how many people enter this magnificent competition?
We had 18 contestants this year.
And is it a fair selection of ages, genders? What type of person is
this year? It's all been male. I mean, we have had females in the past. We've had people from Australia. We've had people from America. We've had people from up the road in Bolton. So we get all types of people entering. Predominantly, it's men who enter the competition. And I think they're all professional pie eaters who enter it.
Okay. How do you become a professional pie eater? And Tom, is that you?
I wouldn't say I'm a professional pie eater, no, but I can say I can eat a pie quite quick.
Right. I mean, presumably you've done it faster than 14.9 seconds.
Not today I didn't, but about 2 years ago I did. Well, that was in a different competition down in Blackpool, down at the Jeans Pub.
Okay. How do you do it that quickly?
I don't actually have a method towards it, to be honest. I just kind of open my mouth and put it in and eat it, really, as quick as I can. And to choke on it.
Okay. I'm going to run out of questions with you, Tom.
For you, it sounds like you could enter this. There's no sort of method behind it. You just got to go quite far.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. When did you discover that you had this immense talent, Tom?
Well, my mum told me to take my time with my food rather than eat my tea and stop inhaling it all the time. I realised that I could eat food quite quick at that point.
Okay. And, I mean, how big is the pie-eating competition world?
I'd say it's quite big, I suppose. Everyone seems to know about it in Wigan. I'd probably ask Tony for that one.
Tony, tell us about this world of pie eating.
Yeah, the guy started the competition 33 years ago and registered the World Pie Eating Competition, having a bit of fun. And it's gone, I can only describe as berserk. We have done pay-per-view in China with about 4,500 Chinese paying to watch this competition. We sent a pie into space 8 years ago, having 34 million hits. Every year, it's a frenzy with press coming to the competition, and it certainly is a calendar of a sporting event now. So it's gone crazy.
It certainly has. Tell us a bit more about sending a pie into space.
Well, I've always wanted to send a pie into space and see what the pie came back like. So I got a company who send things into space. We sent it on a weather balloon from Wigan, and it ended up in Lancaster, probably about 30 miles up the road. And I wanted to see what the pie would be like when it came back down. And there wasn't any difference in the pie. So we've frozen the pie and kept the pie. And one day we'll do something with it. I don't know what we'll do with it, but we've still got the pie. So there was no difference in whatsoever the pie was like.
Now, this eating things fast and eating weird things is actually a huge thing, isn't it, on the internet? So I can understand why people are paying to watch this competition. Does it change the nature of it a bit, though, if it is becoming a thing that you do to get clicks and get hits? Does it in any way take away the magic?
Well, I think the magic is I started it 33 years ago when the World Wide Web wasn't the World Wide Web. There was no Facebook, Twitter, etc., etc. And I think there's nothing better in the world that we live in with the doom and gloom. We have this competition every year just before Christmas. We get a lot of people coming down to watch the competition, a lot of press interest, and my job is done if I can put a smile on somebody's face because of this competition that we do.
We've certainly
done that today.
Well, absolutely fantastic, and all hail to you, Tony, especially at this time of year, because it's exactly why we wanted to talk to you and to talk to Tom, because it's just making us smile.
Can I ask, Tony, what happened with the potential cheating last year?
Well, we have people always cheat in this competition. I mean, I don't allow lubricants in the competition, so they can't get the pie down quickly. Last year, we had a contestant from Bury, just up the road. Now, Bury is very well known for black pudding rolling and eating, and he went in 1 hour competition. So I always like it. We're going to win in the competition, if at all possible. But this year, we have CCTV in the pub, and we spotted, the manageress spotted, a council bin man coming in. We knew he was a bin man because he had high vis on Wigan Council, and got chatting and told one of his mates to bring a funnel in so he could catch bits of pie and it wouldn't go on the floor. Because, of course, we can't allow any pie spillage.
Oh, but why would that be cheating?
Well, you've got to eat the entire pie.
Oh, I see.
So if you drop it on the floor, it's unfair on the other contestants.
Or stuff something in your pocket.
Stuff something in your pocket. You've got to have an empty mouth. And, of course, we've had the binge eating society, because when the competition started, it used to be we had a pile of pies and eat as many pies as you could in 3 minutes. But it isn't really good for your health.
Yeah, that's definitely not to be recommended.
I think the fastest eating pie is better, isn't it?
Are you inspecting the mouths when they're empty?
We do, yeah. We have quite a few, with about five of us officials there. And, of course, we've got to have a good look in the mouth and make sure it's empty. And Tom's mouth was certainly empty today.
Tom, what do you actually win, apart from the enormous accolade of being the fastest pie eater in the West?
You win a trophy and the pride of the town, I suppose.
Yep. And do you eat everything fast when you're not in competition?
Yeah, definitely, most certainly. Yeah.
Do you? What's it like going out to dinner with you? I mean, are you leaving your dining companions about 25 minutes behind you?
Yeah, normally I'm in and I'm out, normally, type job. I don't like to hang around, so let's get in there and get out straight away, pretty much.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Very happy Christmas to you. Take care with too many pigs in blankets, although Christmas dinner. Wow, what do you think your time is for Christmas dinner?
Maybe under 3 minutes, three and a half minutes I'll go for.
Oh, Tom, make it last, love. Make it last. Best meal of the year. But congratulations, Tom. Thanks for being such
a
sport. And Tony, what an absolute joy to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful Christmas.
Yes, okay. Bye-bye. That's Tony Callaghan, who's the owner of Harry's Bar, which holds that competition. I love the fact that in the first answer, Rosie, so people come from all over Australia and Bolton.
Yeah, I know. And quite interesting to note, they like a Wigan winner.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. The judges will have to be absolutely scrupulous then to make sure that really the mighty winner was there. Tom, who was very quick at eating pies and quick at answering questions as well.
Yeah, everything he does in record time.
It's true. Yeah. Coming up here, the doctor strikes. They enter their second day today. That is at the same time as flu hospitalisations have hit record levels. So how is the NHS holding up? We will check in. First, though, let's get the news with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. The Bank of England has reduced interest rates to their lowest level for almost 3 years. The quarter percentage point cut to 3.75% is the fourth this year. The Times' deputy business editor Tracy Bowles says it should stimulate some growth.
In the sense that people have lower mortgage payments if they're on tracker mortgages, fixed rate deals should come down, puts more money in your pocket, should give the economy a boost that way, yes. It's a balance between how the economy's performing and inflation. So they're taking the risk that inflation is going to come down because the rates are the main tool for controlling it.
The bank forecasts inflation will fall closer to its 2% target next year. Flu cases have continued to rise to record levels for December. An average of 3,140 flu patients were in hospital in England each day last week, up 18% on the week before. PPE Medpro, the company linked to the former Conservative peer Michelle Mohn, has been wound up by a court. It could mean the government's unlikely to get back most of the £148 million it's owed after the company was found to have breached a COVID contract for surgical gowns. Sir Keir Starmer's business advisor is out of the running to be the next British ambassador to Washington. Varun Chandra was the front-runner for the role, but it's thought the Prime Minister is now preparing to appoint a career diplomat to replace Peter Mandelson instead. And Australian police have rammed a car carrying a group of men believed to be travelling towards Bondi Beach, who they say were possibly planning a violent act. Seven people have been arrested. However, police insist that this counter-terror operation is not connected to the anti-Semitic shootings on Bondi Beach over the weekend. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wickes local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wickes.co.uk.
It is 2:34. In the studio with us, John Pienaar, head of Times Radio Drive at 4 o'clock. John, good afternoon.
Hi, hello. Well, so I guess like all of us, I'm looking at the government's strategy about violence against women and girls. It's really hard. Is it even possible to argue that a strategy is a good idea? And there's no doubt about the problem. I mean, I think if you do cross that line, the question is how do you do it well? And so, I mean, what sort of guidance and teaching and intervention do we need in schools? Because all of those things are delicate, and it's as easy to get them wrong as right. We're talking about teachers who've got enough on their plate just teaching kids how to writing and reading and the stuff that they've got to do in a normal curriculum, let alone intervening in the way they're developing and growing and the way their own private home lives and outside school lives are being conducted, and what a teacher can do and should do about that. This is delicate stuff, especially when it touches on parents outside. Difficult for any teacher in this field, especially so. So I'm talking to people who know a bit about this, who can really add something to the conversation. For example, the boss of Mumsnet. For example, the boss of Refuge. For example, a head teacher. For example, a former head teacher who used to be a high-level political advisor. So between all of them, we should get some useful, I think, insights into all of this. We're looking at the meeting in Brussels about finding a way to get an awful lot of money to Ukraine. Interesting, especially now, given the overnight stories about the White House trying to squeeze these European leaders not to do this. And on the other, you've got the Kremlin trying to threaten and twist their arms in various different ways not to do this. So they're getting it from all angles. Other things too, but I'm also talking about cookery shows. I mean, not so much as cookery shows and recipes, but just what are they? Why do we like cookery shows? Because I do at Christmas or other times too. It's not about eating. It's not about cooking. It's about the vicarious experience of a perfect, ideal Christmas. And a lot of people enjoying the Mary Berry, Jamie Oliver Christmas thing are going to be watching it and enjoying it and sort of somehow imagining they're there.
Yeah. It's a very good question to ask, isn't it?
Are you the chef on Christmas Day, John?
I would be lying if I said I really was. I mean, I do, I hope, my bit, okay? I mean,
Which is
a good deal of peeling.
Okay. You know. Setting the table, maybe.
You're a sous chef, aren't you, in your kitchen?
And if my family were here, they're saying, if I said, you know, I do loads of cleaning up and washing up, they'd say, yeah, right. But I mean, you know, I swear I do a reasonable amount when I'm awake.
Thank you for your honesty, John. That is John Pienaar here on Times Radio at 4 o'clock.
A quick one in from Keith, who says, "Hey, Fee, you talk about misogyny all you want. As a bloke of 55, I'm appalled at the state of violence against girls. In my opinion, though, it's not at 11 years old where intervention is needed. I think it should be much earlier, in primary school years 1, 2 and 3, with psychological guidance about relationships and identity. We had fewer problems with boys when they were allowed to run around with toy guns expressing their natural boyness. Let kids be natural with supervision and guidance." We're 0333 003 2353 this afternoon. We're being inundated with your proud moments. One of you will win a £250 Wix voucher for being a proud peacock by the end of the programme at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Now, the NHS is on high alert as the number of people being admitted to hospital with flu continues to rise. Cases are slowing in some parts of the country, but the NHS is stressing the service is nowhere near out of the woods. Let's talk to Nick Hume, Chief Executive of East Suffolk and North Essex NHS Foundation Trust. A very good afternoon, Nick. How are you coping?
Certainly, flu has hit us much earlier this year than we'd planned. We always have our seasonal variation plan, knowing that the winter is going to be more challenging, particularly through the front door with respiratory illness. But we expected the flu surge to hit us sort of Christmas and just after. So we had additional capacity, additional beds ready to open. We opened them about 2 weeks ago. It's interesting, though, it's not consistent right across the entire East of England, for example. So 4.5% of our beds on the Ipswich site have got flu patients in against a national average of 3%, and it's just 3% on the Colchester site. So even within the space of kind of 20, 25 miles, we're seeing a different presentation of flu into our hospitals.
And can you just explain why that might be? Is it because one part of the country, one part of your patch has come out of a severe amount of flu cases or is yet to go into it?
I think it's probably the latter is yet to go into it in Colchester. We normally see it the other way around, Colchester being slightly closer to London. It seems to be hit first. And we've also been looking at, for example, community vaccination rates. That can often be a trigger for higher flu numbers, obviously, if the community more generally. But we're not seeing that. The levels are not quite as high as we'd like them to be in terms of vulnerable people, particularly having their flu vaccinations. But it doesn't seem to be a driver necessarily in our patch at the moment.
What impact are strikes having on you?
Well, it is having an impact because clearly a lot of our senior consultant staff are acting down in terms of providing emergency care at the front door and on our wards and elsewhere. So there is an impact on our elective care. But at this time of year, we're always challenged. It always makes it slightly more difficult to run the NHS. And clearly with so many resident doctors being out on strike, about 40% of our residents have decided to take industrial action over the past couple of days. We're kind of bracing ourselves a little bit for the weekend. And of course, if you use consultant staff as we have to in terms of covering nights and covering additional shifts, then they're not available going into next week. So one of my concerns is normally we have a bit of a clear out, more discharges towards the Christmas break, Thursday, Friday next week. I'm just hoping that we get some traction in terms of getting those discharges at the beginning of next week. Otherwise, sadly, people will be in hospital when they don't necessarily need to be over the Christmas holiday.
And can you explain, Nick, what might happen if there were to be a large surge in the number of admissions and therefore beds needed for flu or COVID patients, coupled with strike action? And there is the ability for a hospital to try and call back in staff, isn't there? When does that actually get used and can you use it?
If we can, it's used rarely. I don't think it's, I mean, there are specific services where not ourselves, but other organisations have gone back to the BMA and asked what we call derogation in terms of to make an exception and to require resident doctors who are on strike to come in. We haven't faced that situation, but certainly if we were faced with a major incident, God forbid, you know, that there was a major crash or those sort of classic major incidents, then we do have an agreement with the BMA, a national agreement, that the doctors will come in. I mean, they will anyway. You know, we know that no matter what their views might be about their terms terms and conditions, their training numbers, or indeed their pay, they are, at the end of the day, professionals, and they will come in extremists. But at the moment, we're not in that situation. So we are seeing that flu surge, particularly on our Ipswich site. We are managing it well, but there will be a long-term impact well into next year in terms of the activity we're having to cancel now, having to rebook those patients in clinical priority. It means they may get booked in out of the waiting list into the new year.
Right, OK. Can we talk a little bit about vaccination? You mentioned community vaccination before. There's been a very low take-up of the flu vaccination and COVID vaccines as well by people who are eligible. And, you know, we talk about what the reasons for this vaccine hesitancy might be, but does it frustrate you that even in a season of super flu, and when this is in the news a lot about how stressed the NHS will be, not least because of strike action, that people aren't overcoming that hesitancy?
It does. It frustrates me hugely. And I think it even frustrates me within our organisation, because not all of our staff have availed themselves of the vaccine. I find it really, really difficult to understand. We know that the vaccine is safe. We know that it's accessible. We know that GPs are contacting those patients who are eligible for the vaccine. It's free. I cannot understand why people would not. I think many years ago, many, many years ago, when the vaccine perhaps wasn't as accurate, it didn't necessarily cover all the strains, and there are still anecdotes around that giving the flu vaccine as a live vaccine and it makes you feel awful for 3 or 4 days. That simply isn't the case anymore. But people have long memories, and these myths pertain, I think, in terms of the human psyche, the public psyche. So I think we should be perhaps pushing the vaccines a little bit more. It was interesting, of course, during the COVID days, when the vaccine was first made available, people were literally queuing around the block to get the vaccine. And so, you know, flu can be very, very serious. It's not just a tickly cough and feeling a bit rough. For people with an underlying condition, a long-term condition, the vaccine, particularly for them, is absolutely essential in terms of not only protecting themselves, but protecting their families, protecting their friends, and ultimately protecting the community. Yeah. So it is frustrating that people don't avail themselves of the vaccine.
And Nick Hume, can we talk just a little bit more about that vaccination for frontline staff? Do you think it could ever be made compulsory? According to the Health Service Journal, fewer than 1 in 10 frontline NHS staff have been vaccinated at some trusts. I mean, that is extraordinarily low.
It is low and very concerning. I think, you know, if you look at carefully, for example, GMC guidance very clearly states that it is a professional responsibility for doctors to protect themselves from contagious disease. Now, you know, I don't think, particularly in the current environment, we want to be enforcing that with our medical staff. But I think, for me, it is about reminding people of their professional responsibilities to protect themselves and others. We're at about 45-50%, so that's still not as high as I'd like it to be, clearly better than some. I think mandating people to take the vaccine is difficult. I think I'd be much happier to ask people to think about their professional responsibilities, their responsibilities, and frankly, yourselves from an infection and disease that is really unpleasant and can, in very, very small number of cases, be fatal.
Nick, thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon. Nick Hume is Chief Executive of East Suffolk and North Essex NHS Foundation Trust. We had some bubbles on the line at the end there, but I think we could quite clearly understand his message.
Coming up here, our inside look at the Times magazine ahead of its release this weekend, including an eye-watering wardrobe malfunction. It is 3:15. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts, and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
The Story. The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
End 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op, Group Food Stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is a available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
This is Times Radio.
Now, Jane Mulcairns is the associate editor of The Times magazine. She always gives us a sneak peek into what's coming up this weekend. At this time, I caught up with her a little earlier.
Shall we start with the interview with this doctor that Fraser Nelson has sat down with, and he has been treating children for three decades. He says he's seeing more and more of them who aren't talking at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very distressing but really interesting piece. So this is Dr. Sanjeev Nichani, who's a consultant at Leicester Children's Hospital. He's been there for about 30 years, where he specialises in critically ill children. And he's worked at Great Ormond Street, he's worked in LA, you know, he's got great experience in dealing in paediatric care. And he has general clinics for things like asthma, allergies, skin conditions. But they have allowed him to observe something else, which he is calling the screendemic, which is this massive surge in anxiety, depression, and as you mentioned, like, you know, what presents as kind of ADHD or autism, but actually it's attention disorders and social withdrawal, he believes, caused by screens. It's very, very interesting because he says, as we all know, there are many, many more cases of what is diagnosed as and purported to be ADHD and autism amongst children. But he says there are two different sorts, that there is basically acquired ADHD. Well, first of all, there's primary ADHD, which is, you know, that which children are born with. But then he talks about this acquired ADHD, which he thinks is a version of a disorder which is actually induced by digital media and by the amount of screens that they're using. And that, he believes, is curable, which is good. But he really, really does think that the surge in mental health cases is basically because the emotional circuits in our brains are basically affected by using screens. And he said, I mean, there's so many aspects of this that are very sad, is that parents of children who have genuine ADHD, so, you know, what he calls primary ADHD, give them devices to help calm them down, but actually they're making the condition worse.
Yeah, he talked about seeing a potty that had an inbuilt iPad holder.
Unbelievable.
And he said he thought that was an issue sort of quite funny, and you realise, actually, that is totally tragic. The saddest part for me was when he speaks to these children, asks them what their hobbies are, they don't have an answer.
Have any
10-11 year olds?
No, and this is the thing, so they're just in their rooms scrolling. And he does say that this acquired ADHD, I mean, he's got a very simple cure for it. He believes that the cure is just simply physical activity. And so he's written this book, which is why Fraser's met him, and his book is about movement is medicine. And he says the hippocampus, which is, you know, the bit of our brain that sort of is the hub of memory and mood, it actually shrinks, it contracts with screen exposure, but aerobic activity and physical activity can trigger the release of growth hormones, which kind of open it up again. So basically they help ameliorate the effects of the screens. And it also then obviously also releases things like serotonin and dopamine and lowers cortisol, so makes them less stressed. So basically the physical activity kind of works on the same circuit, but in opposition to screen time. And he's just saying that 30 to 45 minutes of movement three times a week, it gives massive, massive neurological gains, and that children sleep better, you know, their attention recovers, their mood stabilizes, they're less irritable. But I mean, I do have to say, I mean, I think it would be a very, very difficult thing to say to parents who believe their child is seeking ADHD diagnosis to say, actually, they just need to go out and play football.
Yeah, you can imagine that's a tricky pitch. It's a brilliant read. And yeah, as you say, it really is quite sad. Let's move on to someone whose job is basically to make us laugh. Rob Brydon, the sort of all-round nice guy. It does seem to be, in this interview inside the magazine, he does seem to be an all-round nice guy off our TV screens too.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely. So, I mean, honestly, I know this is the last MAG issue before Christmas, and I don't think there could be anything more festive than Rob Brydon in a velvet jacket on the cover of the Times magazine. Famously nice. I guess when we think of him, we kind of think of him as such a showbiz stalwart these days, sort of Gavin and Stacey, the trip, the brilliant trip with Steve Coogan. But he didn't actually get into TV until he was 35. Marion and Jeff, which is his kind of spoof show, he got picked up by Steve Coogan's production company. And until then, Rob Brydon had been a DJ on Radio Wales, and then he moved to London to do voiceovers. Not earning badly, he was earning £200,000 a year doing voiceover for Toilet Duck.
£200,000, it sort of says he got his break at age 35. I think you'd kind of broken in before that.
Well, he'd broken in, definitely. But it is, I mean, he says no disrespect to whoever's doing drive time on Three Counties Radio now, as he would be. But he said, I was very ambitious. I mean, how rude. But he also sort of, you know, I think he also counters that by saying he's not so ambitious that he's very tempted by Hollywood. So he does all these kind of what he, you know, sort of calls light entertainment shows. You know, he's got this new show called The Floor on ITV. He's done things like...
Would I Lie to You?
Yeah. Destination X and stuff, as well as all the biggies like Gavin and Stacey. But he basically doesn't want to go to LA. He says he doesn't want to go and stand in front of a green screen in Atlanta. He'd rather do a live show in London and go home and be able to take his kids to school. I mean, he's obviously not doing badly doing that, but I do think it's an interesting decision that he's made. And I do wonder how much of it is because of his own sort of experiences growing up. So he talks in this interview really movingly about his sort of his very steady attitude to life and how sensible he's always been. He didn't drink till he was 35. He's never done drugs. Very unlike other showbiz people who he's quite close to.
Yeah.
You know, who famously have sort of gone off the rails a bit. But his younger brother died of a cot death when Rob was six. And he said it was so traumatic for his parents. And he just felt like he really needed to be sensible. Like that was his job, was to be sensible. And when he got his first job at Radio Wales, he got a starter home. You know, he sort of very diligently like writes down everything he spends. You know, he's just a very, very sort of sensible person who hasn't been sort of waylaid by, you know, the razzle-dazzle of showbiz.
But however,
he
did star in Barbie.
Probably the biggest
blockbuster of last year. It was a very small part. I think probably not even 10 words, but he did really have his moment.
But it stole the show completely. And he has admitted in this piece that he's also embraced wellness. He's got a sauna and a plunge pool in his back garden. And he really likes creatine. He says, well, he's never taken drugs. If his doctor said he couldn't have creatine anymore, he'd kick off.
Okay, so he's on the supplements then.
He's on the supplements,
great.
Yeah.
Now, there is a brilliant interview with Kate Reardon, the former Tatler boss who now edits Times Lux, which I'm sure you've seen. She really gives you the realities of life behind the scenes of the most glossy of glossy magazines. And there are some incredible backstories here, including how she got her very first job almost accidentally over some cocktail sausages.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes think that Jane Garvey thinks that this is what my life is like on the 11th floor, that it is very Devil Wears Prada. She actually asked me what, she said, what do you do on the magazine? Do you just sit around chatting all day? Yes, Jane, we do. But no, my colleague Kate Reardon, who sits close to me on floor 11 and edits our Lux supplement now, she genuinely did live that Devil Wears Prada lifestyle. She worked for Vogue in New York under Anna Wintour, then Vanity Fair, before editing Tatler in London. And yes, as you say, she got her first big break going to work for Vogue in New York because she was handing out cocktail sausages at her parents' party. And someone said, what would you like to do? And she said, I want to work in fashion magazines. And then they helped her with an intro. And at 19 years old, she was, you know, she went off to New York to work as a fashion assistant for Vogue. And she's writes such funny stories about these, you know, just the wild times in a fashion mag in the 80s and early 90s.
Some of them make you feel unwell, like she was in charge. I mean, at age 21, she was the fashion editor of Tatler. Yeah. If they knew what happened before, you think they might have thought twice, but she's in charge of getting all the clothes, everything to a shoot. And this is all about supermodels getting off speedboats.
In helicopters, yeah.
And what's happened?
Well, someone said, where are the shoes? And she'd left all 200 pairs of shoes behind in the office in Manhattan 3 hours away. Oh. So they did all these pictures with, you know, very famous supermodels jumping on and off helicopters and speedboats, and they had to crop them all at the knee. because no one had any shoes on. But she writes so well in this piece, Kate, about, she can't remember why, but she was friends with Rod Stewart during this time. She says, well, not friends exactly. I was 19, working at Vogue, and wherever he and his band were on tour, me and a couple of girlfriends would get together with him and hit the town. She says, it's only just occurred to me, the correct term is groupie. She says, but Rod was 30, she said, this was 37 years ago. Rod was old to me, even then, but not unattractive. It was a hoot. She tells about how they once got thrown out of a fashionable uptown restaurant because she dared him to walk into the bar and order a drink without his trousers on. It was absolutely brilliant. Claudia Winkleman was her PA. She says she was spectacularly bad at the job. Once Claudia Winkleman went missing on a shoot on a yacht in Thailand, and they just found her having a little sleep on deck. They just left her to it.
Sunbathing. Quite amazing. I can't let you go, Jane, without the final anecdote. It is very good to know that fashion editors of our most prestigious fashion magazines can have rather spectacular wardrobe malfunctions.
I mean, it does make your blood run cold. And also, as you say, it makes you feel better knowing that, you know,
it can happen to the best.
Someone at this level. So she'd gone to a reception at Buckingham Palace in an amazing outfit, which she'd been lent for the occasion. And she was, you know, holding a conversation with, not a member of the royal family, but, you know, a very important person. And she just felt, was the air conditioning turned up a bit high. And then she realised that the zip had just given way on her dress all the way from the top to the bottom, exposing her skimpy G-string. Mm. So she had to exit Buckingham Palace, just clinging close to the wall, down a staircase, round some balustrades, until she could find the coat check girl to get her coat on before, so she could throw that over herself before she could scurry out. It's obviously a moment that has stayed with Kate, absolutely. But I have to say, it's one of the funniest pieces of the year. It's absolutely brilliant. And the parties at Vanity Fair just sound incredible. I say, bring back those days.
That's Jane Mulcairn's. I feel so much secondary embarrassment for Kate that had happened. What you really want is a really good girlfriend to be right with you, who can stand just behind you and just help you in that scenario, rather than having made to make formal conversation and realise, oh my goodness, how do I extract myself immediately from this scenario?
I'm amazed that there aren't more wardrobe malfunctions, because there are some really daring outfits on display that you know are held together with bits of tape and string
and confidence.
Yes, and luck and a youthful figure. But you do think, gosh, all of the just normal movements that you have to make during a dinner, walking up and down stairs, for example, must be incredibly complicated in some of those dresses. But yeah, that is embarrassing.
I have to say, your pants story earlier reminded me of one that happened to me just last week, when I was having friends over just for some Christmas drinks, basically because I wanted my Christmas tree to be seen by more than just myself. And one of my friends said, some of your pants are in the corridor.
Oh,
oh my gosh. I made a very hasty exit to go and retrieve them, because they'd fallen down the back of the radiator and then onto the floor.
How did
they get there?
Yeah. Why were your pants in the corridor?
Yeah, well, they were certainly dry, and they had been drying there, and then they were for anyone to walk to the bathroom to see, but not for very long.
Okay, as a relatively new friend to you, I'm going to say stop now.
I will.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
It is now 3 o'clock and you're listening to Fee and Rosie here on Times Radio. Plenty to come in the next half an hour of the programme. We're going to talk about violence with women and girls and strategies that the government has announced to try and tackle that epidemic. How do you protect a modern day president? And we will also talk to the fabulous Chris McCausland. He's got a documentary out all about the advances in AI and what that means to him as a blind man. All after the news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Fee. Thank you. The Chancellor has celebrated falling interest rates after the Bank of England cut its base rate for the fourth time this year. Rachel Reeves says it means rates are falling at the fastest pace for 17 years.
It's welcome news for families and businesses that the Bank of England have now cut interest rates six times since the general election. What it means for a first-time buyer with a sort of average-size mortgage is £100 less a month because of these successive cuts in interest rates.
The bank previously thought inflation would not come back to its 2% target until 2027, but says that will now happen next year. The Conservatives say government policy has kept inflation higher than it otherwise would have been. NHS officials say the health service is not out of the woods as the number of flu patients rises again. An average of 3,140 people were in hospital in England each day last week with flu, up 18% on the week before. That's a record for this time of year, but that growth rate is slowing from earlier on in the month. Nick Holm is chief executive of East Suffolk and North Essex NHS Foundation Trust. He says that the current resident doctors' strike could impact how quickly hospitals can clear their beds.
If you use consultant staff as we have to in terms of covering nights and covering additional shifts, then they're not available going into next week. So one of my concerns is normally we have more discharges towards the Christmas break. I'm just hoping that we get some traction in terms of getting those discharges at the beginning of next week. Otherwise, sadly, people will be in hospital when they don't necessarily need to be.
The government's preparing to postpone local elections for millions of people for a second year until 2027. It's because local leaders have asked for more time to prepare for reforms, abolishing the two-tier county and district council system, but it is likely to provoke a backlash from the Liberal Democrats and Reform UK. The Prime Minister says the government's new plan to teach boys as young as 11 about combating misogyny is intentionally targeting younger children. The strategy places more emphasis on teachers and parents to tell teenagers about healthy relationships and how to stop misogyny to reduce violence against women and girls. The lessons could include image-based abuse, peer pressure, coercive behaviour, online harassment and stalking. But the Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel D'Souza, says some boys simply need support and encouragement.
If you read all the literature, all you would think is that they're on incel sites, they've got no communication skills, and they've all got like behaviour problems. Rubbish. We've got to catch them doing good things. We've got to recognise some of the needs for boundaries and, you know, exciting fun and outside. We need those male role models.
And the King has officially opened a new Guinness brewery in central London by pulling a pint.
Leave it down.
Keep going. Okay. So we want it just a little dome on the top of the pint. So I'd say stop now.
That's absolutely gorgeous. Lovely.
Lovely round of applause. That's an absolutely perfect pint of Guinness.
If you say so.
Yeah.
The King visited the site in Covent Garden this morning. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Fee Glover, Rosie Wright with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. So a really fascinating interview with Chris McCausland, the blind comic, comes your way after 3:30. If you're thinking, oh my goodness, would he describe himself as a blind comic? He absolutely would. He's got a memoir out at the moment called Keep Laughing, in which he details losing his sight, which happened to him in his early 20s. He is very, very proud of everything that he has gone on to achieve. He's a very self-aware man, and he's got a very interesting take on our attitude towards AI and new technology at the moment. So that is definitely, definitely worth your time after 3:30. Also, before the end of the show, we will announce who's won the £250 Wickes Proud as a Peacock voucher. And we're also going to talk about the very real problem of trying to protect a modern day president in this half an hour of the programme. We're going to start with one of the top stories of the day, though. Boys as young as 11 being sent on anti-misogyny courses as part of new plans to tackle violence against women and girls. Lessons on consent, on not sharing intimate images, and promoting good role models will be part of the government's new strategy. Jess Phillips is the Minister for Safeguarding and Violence Against Women and Girls, and she told Times Radio Breakfast why the plan is focusing on prevention.
So, look, I suppose the first thing I need to say is that one in eight women were victims of violence against women and girls last year. And so I'm a bit sick, I have to say, as somebody who's campaigned on this for many years, of just trying to put nicer plasters onto ever-growing scars. And so we've got to, the government is really, really focused on the prevention. And one of the things that we are here to announce today is working across the Home Office and the Department for Education, is what will we be doing in schools to both prevent it, whether that's healthy relationship educations, but also targeted interventions for young men where teachers spot behaviours such as the sharing of intimate images, so that we can stop that behaviour progressing into something that may end up even more sinister in the future. And so we will undertake a sort of, we have to build new models of how to do this, because there isn't just a thing I can grab off the shelf from another country. We will be the first place to try and do this. And so we will find evidence-based interventions that work, and we will offer those as resources to schools.
Labour's Jess Phillips there. The feminist and women's rights campaigner Julie Bindle joins us to talk through all of this. Julie, a very good afternoon from us. What do you make of this?
I think it's nowhere near enough. And also, Jess Phillips is wrong when she says we will be the first country to try this. Countries all around the Western world have been going into schools, talking to boys, talking to girls, doing the whole healthy relationship thing. Now, of course, that should be part of the curriculum. We shouldn't be making an assumption that 11-year-old boys are misogynists. There's no point training them out of misogyny when they don't even know what the word is. But parents, schools, we all have a role in that. But, for example, Sweden in 1999 recognised, after campaigning by feminists and social workers and others, that prostitution was part of violence against women. It was wholly wrong, it was harmful, and it was a human rights violation. And they put anti-prostitution measures in their violence against women strategy in 1999. And what they recognised was education alone of the public, from school children through to adult men and women, wouldn't be enough unless you couple it with legislation. So the education was, this is wrong, this is harmful, this causes distress, it's not right to purchase another person's body, and therefore we will criminalise those that do so. And here's the information that you need to understand why we have this law. We also saw the law with stopping smoking in public buildings. It works so long as there's a sanction at the end of it. Now, I'm fairly liberal when it comes to the criminal justice system. I would empty the prisons of most people, aside from those that are dangerous to other humans and animals. But really, they're trying to tell us, this government, that they're doing enough by talking to 11-year-olds when the criminal justice system is on its knees, when there's no resourcing for training for judges to dispel the myths about rape victims, domestic violence victims, where the women and girls that suffer such horrific crimes are waiting 3-4 years to get into court, by which time they're more likely to drop the case, and that we're moving further away from a criminal justice system response to men's violence by using nothing but perpetrator programmes and sitting in rooms with men having tea and biscuits and chatting to them about their feelings.
Right.
No, but it's not enough.
OK, I mean, I completely hear you on all of those things, Julie, but aren't we talking about something a bit different here, which isn't about expecting young people to understand the ramifications of a very poor criminal justice system? We are talking about something that challenges a mindset about, literally about how young people think about each other.
How can it challenge a mindset, though, with respect, if we have huge platforms such as Pornhub and all of the other platforms, including some that would not describe themselves as porn sites, which are available despite the age verification legislation, which makes it a little bit trickier for some, but perfectly possible for those that know the way around it, when they're accessing this violent imagery, when their peer groups and older boys are telling them that effectively, and they wouldn't use these words, but effectively, you can abuse a girl or a woman and be pretty much guaranteed to get away with it. We have a 1% conviction rate from reporting rape and sexual assault through to the end. We cannot just do it on talking to kids in schools alone. It's only a start if you couple it with talk about real sanctions further down the line, because they're going to be 13, 14, they're going to be the age of criminal responsibility before you know it. So it's not going to work if they don't sort out the criminal justice system.
Right. So are you saying that there's just no point in what has been announced today?
I'm not saying there's no point. What I think that the government's doing is window dressing. I think that they're trying to be clever and calling it prevention, when in fact real prevention would be making sure that the system is worth what it's doing, what it's supposed to do, where there's real protection for girls who are often abused in the home, who are not necessarily being abused by strangers or by boys in the schoolyard, but that the violence in the home, which is the most likely arena for it to take place in, is not being criminalised. Let's not forget what 11-year-old boys, many of them, are learning from, is their violent father, stepfather, other male relative that may be abusing their mother as well as themselves. So we need to tackle all of those issues before we have a hope in hell of being able to speak sense to 11-year-old boys with everything else that's going on around them. And my concern about it isn't that they shouldn't be doing this. Of course, we've been doing education, myself included, in schools for many, many decades. But what we recognise is if it's done alone with no propping up of the system, then it's going to fail.
OK. Would you at least agree that early intervention is going to be quite a welcome thing? We know, and this is with evidence, that quite often, the path to serious violence and harm delivered by a man against a woman is something that many people within society might think of as a little bit innocuous. It starts with watching porn. It starts with not completely understanding consent. And then it leads to enormous problems further down the line. And actually, there is something bold in saying, even at the age of 11, we're going to set up a program that will try and identify a very young boy who we could help him on a better journey through his life. That's quite bold, isn't it?
It's been done for decades. Feminists and those in the women's sector have been going into schools and running these kind of programmes for decades. It really isn't anything new. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be talking to young people about this, to boys and to girls. But if you look at the societal pressure around them, if you look at, as I say, the porn trade, if you look at the normalisation of so many forms of violence against women, yes, the message may well get through to these 11-year-olds, most of whom are very sweet, innocent boys who wouldn't dream of harming a fly. But once they get to the age where they recognise that actually it's the Wild West out there when it comes to doing whatever they like to girls, to committing criminal acts that involve sexual violence, then they're not going to think back to their teacher telling them that it's not very nice and respectful. What they need is to recognise that we take this seriously. We need to get people to recognise that so far there is very, very little to deter abusers if they think that they're going to get away with it. And unfortunately, the vast majority of those that do commit these acts, including young men, very young men in their teens, do get away with it. Yeah. We need to address that.
I think your point about teachers is a very relevant one, Julie, because actually, if you're going to expect the bloke who teaches you physics to then suddenly manage to turn on a Wednesday afternoon into the guy who's going to talk about consent and taking intimate images, that's an awkward position. And for an awful lot of kids, that's simply not going to work, is it? You do need to find peers who can tell young boys these messages.
You do, and there are some good groups, and I think that we do need to have way more after school clubs, youth clubs, as we used to refer to them back in the day. And there are some men who are doing this, such as Men at Work, Michael Conroy, who I've known for many years, who talks to boys and young men about these issues in a non-judgmental way and couples it with talking to them about other issues that they might be facing that's making them unhappy. And so I think we need to be a bit more imaginative about it. But I would disagree with Jess Phillips that this is prevention work. I think this is one of a tiny little grain in the sand when it comes to the work that we need to do. And this government, it really needs to get the criminal justice system into shape before it can even think about prevention.
The equally important part of the strategy that we haven't seen empowered yet is also the one that the government has alluded to, where they would push for nudity detecting algorithms on phones, which would actually stop users taking intimate photos and sharing them unless the phone belongs to an adult. Nothing is foolproof with tech. We understand that. But that would definitely help, wouldn't it? But that involves really, really putting pressure on technology companies. And I wonder what your thoughts are about the government's capacity and willingness to do that.
Well, when the government announced its strategy, it got a couple of things wrong, one of which was that they would be criminalising strangulation. Well, strangulation is already criminalised. What they meant, and they got wrong in the press release, was that they would be criminalising pornographic imagery and footage of strangulation. And so if we need to look at nudity as the issue, well, yes, that can be a driver towards pornography. But what we really need to do is have a look at what the porn companies and other tech companies are getting away with. It's effectively, it's largely unregulated. It really is. And there's very few sanctions for them. It was tried a few years ago with credit card companies saying that they wouldn't recognise, you know, cards from fee-paying users. And then, of course, that was soon reversed because, you know, money is the biggest turn-on for porn barons. So we do need to have a look at this really seriously as to what the government is doing in scrutinising and policing the likes of Pornhub, MindGeek and others. Because talking to boys, as I say, when they've got access to imagery that is giving them the message they can do whatever they want to girls, is far stronger than what a teacher can tell them.
Finally, Julie, can I just ask for your thoughts about where parents are in all of this? And I speak as a parent myself, that I have had to make myself go and look at things that I don't want to look at, just in order to understand what it might be that my teenagers, they're young adults now, and people around them might have access to. And I've been shocked in that process. But I know that quite a lot of my contemporaries have chosen not to do that. There's no way that you can force everybody who's a parent to go and look at the stuff that's out there. But I sometimes think that we don't talk about parental responsibility, the part that we play, enough, because it is a distasteful thing, full stop.
It is. And the majority of young men from boyhood to adulthood are looking at pornography, whether it's in a compulsory way or whether it's occasional. And I think it's really incumbent on us all to know what it means when we talk about pornography. It's not your father's Playboy or penthouse. It's gross, violent misogyny that is a training ground for rape and abuse. And yes, it's distasteful, but so is the idea that young men can be trained into thinking that this equates with sex and sexual pleasure. So we do have a responsibility to look at it.
Yep, I completely agree with you there. Julie Bindle, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. We've got lots of thoughts on this, and it's 0333 003 2353. We will squeeze in as many as we can before the end of the programme, because it is a mighty important issue.
Just to give you a flavour, Helen says, as an ex-primary teacher, I think some of this needs to be taught, as we've just been discussing, to boys and girls together, for everyone to hear that porn is not reflective of normal relationships. There should be mutual respect. Some boys can feel hugely pressured because girls are acting out what they believe is normal. Teach healthy relationships throughout the whole of compulsory education. You know the number to get us on. You can text us as well, 87222. Just make sure you start your message with the word Times. Well, coming up here, how do you protect a president? It's 3:20. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald.
We bring you the best analysis of the headlines of the morning.
We're going to have to deal with the chaotic backlog that the Conservatives have.
Okay, but once you've done that, where are they going to go? Where are the new ones going?
The news doesn't sleep and neither do we.
Isabel in Northampton is really worried about you, Callum. I don't think his bosses should have made him do all these hours. Isabel, he fought to be up overnight.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at Viking.com.
Unfold a world of on-the-go entertainment with the Samsung Galaxy Z Fold 7. The massive 8-inch main screen means you'll see the bigger picture as every exciting moment unfolds. Share every highlight and keep the whole family entertained wherever you go. Buy yours now and claim £300 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix Kitchen Gallery or try the Matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk.
Well, together with Wix, we want to know your proudest moment of the week to be in with a chance to win a £250 Wix voucher in our Wix Peacock Awards. We've had lots of examples so far. Richard has nominated his daughter. So Graham has done as well, nominated his wife, Lorraine. You can send us a WhatsApp 0333 003 2353 or email janeandfee@times.radio and we will announce the winner at the end of the show. Now, Donald Trump has faced multiple assassination attempts, including, you will remember, when he was grazed by a bullet on his ear whilst campaigning for the presidency. Well, one of his would-be killers was meant to be being sentenced in Florida today. The hearing has just now been pushed back. This is Ryan Ruth. He was convicted of plotting to kill Donald Trump, who was the then candidate. He was caught by the US Secret Service when he was spotted aiming his rifle at a golf course where Donald Trump was playing. But in our world of drones, hacking and attacks, we're asking, how do you protect arguably the most powerful person on the planet? Barry DiNardio is a former agent in the US Secret Service, which guards presidents. Barry joins us. Barry, good afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
I think you were tasked with protecting, well, Obama and Bush. Tell us a bit about your job.
Well, as you could imagine, very exciting position to have and a great honor to do that. Being in the Secret Service is a change of life. It's not like any other job you'll ever have. Your life now becomes protecting the president and serving the people of the United States through the United States Secret Service. Imagine protecting somebody or something. Like, imagine if I told you to take an egg and carry it around for a year without ever cracking it. Something that fragile, that's how specific and attention to detail the Secret Service can be. That's how it is protecting a president. Every move is done well in advance. Every plan is done well in advance. And everything is coordinated to a level of expertise, as you can imagine.
So give us an idea. Let's say when you were working with Obama and he was going to make a public speech at a rally, for example, what would you be putting in place to ensure his safety?
Well, only so much I can talk about the security measures of the president of the United States, but I can tell you that there is a tremendous amount of coordination, advanced people on the scene, coordinating with local police. State police as well, assets being brought into place to help coordinate the efforts to protect the president, and expert planning and execution of time management, as you can imagine.
Is it possible to guarantee a president's safety?
I think it's possible to guarantee to get the possibility lowest to zero as possible. Now, in my opinion, overall, can you have an untainted, you know, absolute zero possibility forever that a president can possibly be tried to be assassinated? I don't think that really exists in reality. I know that there is a zero policy mission, but however, it's my thought process that you want to get the possibility as close to zero as possible and keep it there at all times. Could it fluctuate up to a 1%? Anything is possible. But the Secret Service is constantly reevaluating itself to keep itself is to that zero possibility at all times.
Yeah, because look, in this specific case, you have someone aiming a rifle at a golf course where Donald Trump was playing. I mean, that presumably is a colossal security failure.
Well, I don't think it was a failure because they picked up on it and returned fire and saved the president's life. So the countermeasures did take the situation at hand and stop the assassination. The reason why those agents were there to be able to stop that, and they did exactly what they were supposed to do. I'll tell you, Mr. Roth is actually very lucky because the Secret Service on all planes, all dimensions, are surgical shooters, whether it's with a rifle or a pistol. So he's very lucky he's even got a court case because I understand they did return fire. Mm.
What is the biggest threat, actually, that you are protecting the president from when they are out in public?
I think the unknown. I think today's world, which is very different to when I was there, I think AI is a big thing. I think drones are an issue. And then you also have the lone wolf that is just literally undetectable, that doesn't give any evidence whatsoever in a text message or talking to a friend, that just wakes up today and decides to do a violent act and there's no way to trace it. So that is also a concern.
Were there scenarios, if you've got any examples, of where, because of security concerns, you quite radically changed the movements of, let's say, Bush or Obama?
I don't really have a specific scenario other than I could tell you, once we're hired at the Secret Service, the saying is always that the White House is a magnet for crazy people. So in a kind of a comical way to say that the White House, it magnifies people to it that are genuinely can be sick or mentally ill, maybe off their medications, and then suddenly want to go to the White House to have a talk to the President of the United States and show up at the front gate, or show up with hundreds of rounds of ammunition in a car and maybe even a weapon with some possibility of coming to the White House grounds and doing damage. So that seems to be something that happens on a regular basis to where in my career, you know, that would happen. And then, of course, thwarted by the Secret Service, even getting phone calls from a family member that, hey, somebody is not right. They're off their meds and they told me they're coming from Ohio to the White House. You better start looking for them. So that's the kind of stuff that I have seen.
There was that extremely near miss in Pennsylvania where Donald Trump had his ear grazed by a bullet. A member of the public did lose their life, actually, in that round of shooting. Charlie Kirk, obviously very different to a president, but a political figure who was shot dead. I wonder if you think that political violence feels more acute right now.
I agree with you, yes. In the United States, we're seeing political violence that I've never seen in my lifetime or have heard of. We're all experiencing it. It's happening on both sides. So I think both sides need to take a step back. We need to start getting back to politics and voting for who we want as a candidate, who we want to be elected. And don't go any further. You win some, you lose some. You vote, you support the candidates that you like. Everybody has their favorites, but it should never, under any circumstance, resort to violence.
Barry, thank you very much for giving us insight into what an extraordinary job Barry DiNardio, former US Secret Service agent.
So do get your final entries for the Wix Proud as a Peacock Award in. All you have to do, just in a couple of sentences, is tell us why you are proud of somebody. It doesn't have to be something especially profound, although lots of your suggestions really are. I'm so sorry. That's very unprofessional. That's my phone going off in the background. I'm trying to enter my own competition. It's 0333 003 2353, and we'll announce the winner, who gets a 250 quid Wix voucher, and we'll do that just before we say goodbye at 4 o'clock today. Coming up, our big interview is with the comedian Chris McCausland. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Bank of England has cut interest rates for a fourth time this year to 3.75%. It's forecasting inflation will fall to near its 2% target next year after falling unexpectedly to 3.2% for November. Market analyst Rajan Lakhani says the bank will also have been motivated to try to boost growth.
The data on employment figures was quite challenging this week. Unemployment rose to 5.1%. And we saw with the latest economic growth levels, the economy actually contracted by 0.1% and actually shrunk. So it's challenging from an economic perspective.
The Chancellor says it's the fastest rate of cuts for 17 years. Flu cases have continued to rise to record levels for December. An average of 3,140 flu patients were in hospital in England each day last week, which is up 18% on the week before. PPE MedPro, the company which is linked to the former Conservative peer Michelle Mohn, has been wound up by a specialist court. It could mean the government's unlikely to get back most of the £148 million the company still owes the taxpayer after it was found to have breached a COVID contract. And film and TV actors and performers have voted to refuse digital body scans unless they're given stronger protections against AI. The union, Equity, says 99.6% of its members backed the move in an indicative ballot. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. The To-Do List, Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles at Wix. There's a kitchen to suit every home, with prices starting from under £3,000. Start planning your new kitchen. Book a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Chris McCausland started to lose his sight in his 20s. He knew he had the condition retinitis pigmentosa because it's hereditary. His grandmother, his mother and his sister all had it. He is now blind, which is why it was astonishing that he lifted the glitter ball trophy on Strictly Come Dancing, learning all of those steps through verbal description, physical guidance and the clever use of metaphor from his partner Diane Buswell. He's a sought-after comic. He's got his own series on Netflix with the brilliant title Speaky Blinder. He has a memoir out called Keep Laughing. And after he won Strictly, he could take his pick of what to do next. And he told the BBC he wanted to explore the horizon of new technology and AI in a documentary called Seeing Into the Future. Chris has got a degree in software engineering and has always loved his tech. And the documentary makes us step out of the doom loop where AI spells the end of the world as we know it. Although we might see some of the advances in AI as speeding up our world, but undermining human decision-making and therefore human relevance, to Chris, much of it simply means he can join a world we all take for granted. And we join this chat with Chris explaining one of the first scenes in the documentary. We see him in his hotel room in, I think, California, where he's pointing his phone at the clothes in the wardrobe, and the phone is telling him what he might want to pick out to wear.
It's like having a person with you. And if you don't point out that it's AI and people aren't aware of what AI is capable of, they think I've got my wife on FaceTime or something like that because it's talking to me like there's a person looking through the camera on the phone, and it's describing clothing, whether it's whether it needs ironing, whether it's, you know, whether it looks clean. I show it an old band T-shirt from the Deftones, you know, an old metal band, and it even comments, "Oh, what a nostalgic T-shirt!" It's a good. it's nuts when people see it in action, and this is, you know, ChatGPT came out 3 years ago, really, and it's already at the point where it's mind blowing. And you know, this was just using ChatGPT on its video setting through its iOS app on the iPhone. It's already bananas. It's the worst it's going to be. It's only going to get better at these things. It was to show people really what it is capable of and how it can change people's lives.
One of the things, Chris, that people seem to be very fearful about is the way that large language learning models like ChatGPT can appear to be your friend. And definitely for the younger generation, there have already been some horrendous examples of a human being actually thinking that what comes back at them is a person. So are you making that very clear distinction in your mind right from the get-go? Because in a way, we could understand why needing to rely on something within a machine would make you feel more like you were kind of mates with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really I'm not fearful that this is a problem that we haven't encountered before. We had the same problem with the internet. You know, you're giving kids access to strangers, people who can pretend to be, you know, a teenage boy and they're really a 50-year-old man, and you're allowing people to, you know, kids to access, you know, parts of the internet and people from all parts of the world without their parents really being able to keep tabs on their behavior and their actions. And the internet and technology is always throwing up these problems that we need to regulate or we need to solve. You know, my daughter's on Roblox and it's impossible to keep tabs on it. You can only check in every so often, and you can't even on Roblox, you can't even put your child at the age that they are, because they tell you that they can't do any of the things that they need to do with their friends. So you've already got to lie about their age so that they don't have a meltdown and tell you that you're ruining their life. It's always been a problem. You've only got to open up the news these days and read down your Apple News, BBC News feed, whatever it is, that, you know, to see stories of people who've been taken advantage of on dating apps by people who pretended to be somebody they're not, and then you know, stolen money from them, abused them. There are people out there that pretend to be things that they're not. So it's not just something that's specific to technology. It's just that, you know, as it is developed and as it is improved, hopefully we can regulate it and make it better for everybody. But there are also pluses to it. You know, there are people out there that are lonely, that have nobody. There are people that can't afford or get to the doctors, you know, to a counsellor, to be able to just have a conversation. And maybe we're not there yet at that point, but it's in the future of everybody to be able to have a medical diagnosis from, you know, from a bot, so to speak. And there's pluses and negatives to it all. So yeah, it's worth riding it out, I think.
Tell us a bit more about the other things that you found in Silicon Valley and at Meta. Meta make these glasses, don't they, that you showed us what they could do, which was quite phenomenal.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the stuff going to Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook, was to show really what's out there now. And this is the first implementation of mainstream wearables, which are, as I said, if you go back, even not that long, a few years, if you wanted a pair of glasses with a camera on for somebody who's blind, it would have looked like I'd made it. You know, it would have been a hideous thing with a camera bolted on the side, and you would have looked like you were wearing something weird. Whereas these are Ray-Ban glasses that everybody wants. Everybody wants to wear. They just look like normal sunglasses with built-in cameras. And already they offer hands-free accessibility functionality. So one thing that blind people often don't have is two hands for. You've got a hold of a dog, you've got a stick, maybe you've got a bag in the other hand to have access or to have information provided to you from something you've got on your face, which is looking where you are looking but you can't see, is a phenomenal step forward in accessibility. And that's out there now. That's something you can just go in the shop and buy for £300 or £400. It's already, I mean, it's not perfect. You get better results. You get speedier responses doing it through your iPhone. But, you know, everything's got to start somewhere. And to have hands-free artificial intelligence accessibility that is wearable is a good start, yeah, in that domain. You know, it's going to improve.
And you can basically ask your glasses to describe, yeah, what it is that you're, yeah, seeing.
Can you tell me if you can see the door for the news agents? Can you tell me how much this is? You can look at a menu and say, can you tell me what the categories are on the menu? You know, traditionally, if you're doing something with OCR, like optical character recognition, you would have said, read the menu, and it would have read the whole menu from top to bottom. It would have taken you an hour to get to the desserts. Whereas AI is processing it, and it's like having a person there that you can ask, what's on the desserts? Is there anything chocolatey in the desserts? And it'll just tell you. It's such a phenomenal leap forward from what came before it, that it's incredible.
I thought one of the most moving things was your experience of a driverless car. Now, driverless cars over here make most of our listeners just throw up their hands in horror. We can't get our heads around it at all.
Yeah.
But... Let's go through the conduit of your curiosity instead, because for you, it was an extraordinary experience.
Well, so, we've gone from Meta, which is something that is out there now that everybody can buy, to Waymo, which is a Google-owned company who do the self-driving cars in San Francisco and some other cities. And that is, you know, their present, but it's our future. You know, it feels like the future, even though it's out there now. And it's... first time I've ever been in a car that's driving on my own. Obviously I'm blind, so I can't, I've never been able to drive a car. It was remarkable to have that sense of independence and peace and quiet and just have that space to yourself and not be around another human. It was quite refreshing. The safety of it is interesting, because we always want someone to blame. You know, whose fault is it if there's an accident or an incident? And, you know, my background's in maths and, you know, statistics and things. I did a lot of that in A-level. And if it's statistically safer, then surely it's safer, even though it could have incidents along the way. If it's having 8% of the incidents that human drivers are having, then surely it's a lot safer than humans driving. And the reality is that most accidents are not caused in the moment of the accident. Most accidents are caused because somebody's tired, or they've been drinking, or they're looking at the phone, they're talking to someone in the back seat. They happen in the build up to the accident. And if you remove all of those human, you know, faults, so to speak, you drastically reduce the amount of crashes or incidents that will occur. There will be some, and who do you blame for them? That's the problem, isn't it? But already they talk about it as being the most experienced driver in the world. They don't really talk about it as being individual cars. They talk about it as this one kind of driving brain that I think it's driven halfway to the sun so far in total. And the number of incidents it's had along the way are so remarkably small that I don't think you can ignore that.
No, I think it is a careful lady driver, isn't it? That's basically the category.
I think a lot of people, when they think of self-driving cars, they think, because Elon Musk's very vocal and he's got a very big personality, he's always out there, you know, selling his wares. And people think of Teslas and with a self-driving functionality. These cars are not that. These cars have got such an array of sensors on them that they are, they look very different to a commercial family car. They're a car that's being souped up with like a wedding cake of sensors on the roof and LiDAR sensors down the side and all these spinning bits on them. They're quite, you know, futuristic in the way that they've been developed. But they, the guy was telling me that they had one, because they can't teach it every single scenario that it needs to decide what to do. They learn as they're going. And he was telling me that they had one car, a bus had pulled across a crossroads, across an intersection, and was blocking like 70% of the intersection. So the car approached it slowly, went to drive around the back of the bus, and it stopped and waited. And as it waited, a person walked out from behind the bus, and it let the person get out of the way of the car, and the car carried on driving. And they didn't know how the car knew the person was there because the bus was in the way. And they went back and looked at the data. And he said, as the car approached the bus, it saw 2 feet under the bus on the other side. And he thought, well, if there's 2 feet, there must be a person. So I'll just wait for them feet to get out of the way. Wow. And it was like, a human would never see those feet.
Yeah, no, that's so true. That's so true. And is there a bit of you, Chris, that really wishes that this technology had been available to you when you started to lose your sight?
I mean, not really, no. I mean, it's always developing, isn't it? And it's, you know, technology's always been something that I've been dependent on. You know, it's always been something that I've relied on, and to some extent, whether it was specialist or mainstream technology, and I couldn't have done without it. But you know, you could say, "Oh, yeah, I wish we had now what I had when I was younger." But in 10 years' time, it'll be so phenomenally different that we'll look back at it now and go, "God, that was rubbish, wasn't it? I wish I had it now. I wish I had what we got now." But it's. You know, people out there listening to this will be, yeah, but what about, you know, what about the negative aspects of AI? And if, interestingly, you know, there's a documentary on the BBC, not mine. It's Horizon have got a lot of their historical episodes on iPlayer. If you go back, there's an episode from 1977 on there, from the year I was born, and it's about the introduction of the microchip. And if you take the word microchip out of it and put the word AI, it is so ridiculously similar. The symmetry is remarkable. The microchip is going to be taking people's jobs. It's soon you will not need cash. You'll be able to tap your card. And it's you know, there will be no need for tellers in banks. And this is from 50 years ago. And the world adapted, you know. It's you look at the internet. The internet was introduced and suddenly we've got no travel agents on the high street, but the cost of holidays reduced, more jobs became available in the holiday in the travel industry. The world evolves and adapts, yeah. And we've had these same issues along the way and these same fears at different points with the internet, microchips, whatever it is.
And sometimes those travel agents sent you to very odd places, didn't they?
Yeah,
there's
yeah,
definitely
yeah.
a backhander going on from Rob on the high street in Hertfordshire. Will you do more of these programmes? Do you feel that this could be a quite happy home for you?
Yeah, I think it's difficult with this specific area because the companies themselves are so secretive. You know, that we were invited into Apple. I love Apple. Apple has changed my life. You know, everything I use is Apple. Apple were the first mainstream company the first company to really change how accessibility was looked at by mainstream technology companies. But they don't tell you anything, you know. I said, what's the point? They won't tell us anything. By the time it's been on the telly, the new iPhone will be out. They won't even tell us about the iPhone. So it's difficult to kind of make these programs about the advancements in technology when the companies are so secretive about their intellectual property, which is why going to MIT as part of the one we did was great, because they just want to show off with what they're doing, because it's so bananas and it's so kind of forward thinking.
They're not in the closed lid yet, are they?
Yeah, no. And they want people to know what they're doing because they want funding and they want investment and things like that. So that's why going to MIT was like a real breath of fresh air compared to some of these companies. You know, we did do some filming at like OpenAI, who make ChatGPT, and it was nice and it was interesting. It was good to be let in, but you don't you don't learn much that people don't already know, you know.
Yeah, but that's the really frustrating thing, isn't it? That's the bit that we're allowed to get really annoyed about, isn't it, Chris? That these companies, these massive companies that are making things that will change our lives, they do not want to share the process with us at all. So if there is a flaw in a product, if there is a downside to a new genre, we are the guinea pigs. We are the people who eventually have to tell them. If we were all part of the process, wouldn't it be better?
If we were all part of the process, yeah, but we wouldn't. What do you mean? We wouldn't understand how it worked. I mean, we've all watched telly for years without really understanding how the picture gets on the box. Like, I don't think we need to know how it works. We just need to trust the agents involved and
but your
trust.
Comedy, Chris, has probably already been scraped by AI in order to be regurgitated by people who aren't ever going to pay you for it.
But I'm a comedian. I have the only reason I do comedy is because I have scraped Eddie Izzard and I have scraped Jack D and Alan Davis, and I did comedy because I wanted to emulate those guys and I wanted to be a comedian like they were. The only reason Richard Osman writes good books is because he's read a lot of good books. It's to kind of say that AI is the only thing that is influenced or inspired or using styles and techniques of other writers is wrong. Maybe I'm not saying they shouldn't pay for access to this information, but we all do it. We all emulate our heroes and the things that we like, and we try and pass the ideas off as our own, don't we?
Yeah. Well, I love this perspective. I mean, I just think it's so healthy because the fear and the anxiety that so many people are carrying with them about AI just can't be a helpful thing. And the irony, yeah. Chris, as well, is that we will then probably turn to that same AI to help us feel better, won't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you look at the real threat with AI isn't the kind of commercial version of it that we're all kind of getting worried about. The real threat with AI is what bad actors can do with it, in terms of, you know, if you can use AI to develop drugs and treatments for diseases at a rapid pace compared to traditional methods, then you can use AI to develop chemicals that can kill a lot of people. And so it's really what it's used for at that end of the wedge, I think, that is the scary thing. And you know, whether it's reading books and writing poems for people or providing visual interpretation, or, you know, all of these things are going to improve. And the internet is a very, very flawed environment. You know, you've got the dark web proliferation of child pornography, but we all couldn't live without it because it allows us to buy things and have them delivered to the house and use Wikipedia.
It solves Christmas.
AI will be the same. It'll be half good and half bad.
And there's still time to order a copy of Chris McCausland's memoir, Keep Laughing, on any well-known book site and have it delivered in time for Christmas. Chris's documentary, it gets a hard recommend from all of us on the team, and it's available on the iPlayer. Coming up, we're going to tell you who's won our Proud as a Peacock Award. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast. Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio. For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by the Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
The Wickes Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Wickes local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wickes.co.uk.
We've been asking for your proudest moment of the week for a chance to win a £250 Wickes voucher as part of our Wickes Peacock Awards. There's a late contender who tickled your fancy, Rosie.
Well, I really, really can empathise with this. Good afternoon to David, who said, I sing tenor with a small church choir. A couple of weeks ago, I was asked to sing with a choir who were raising funds for the Sunningdale Hope Trust and were short of tenors. The concert was last night. Due to sickness, there was only myself and one other tenor. The rest of the choir were very experienced and very vocal, so I had to sing my heart out to make up for the missing ones. The concert was a great success, and we raised £1,700 for the charity. So today I'm having my peacock moment. David, having done, and this is sort of my proud as a peacock moment, I think 7 carol services with one final one tomorrow, and lots of people disappearing with flu. I really know your pain. Yesterday I was alto 2 with a piece that I wasn't quite up to scratch with as I would have preferred. But when the concert comes, you just have to go for it. So, David, I'm with you there.
Do you ever get a little bit rebellious, and when you're meant to be singing one part in O Come All You Faithful, you just think, no, I've done this 7 times, I'm going to do the other.
Go for the descant, yes. Or something crazy. Occasionally, I would say there are some rebellious characters in my choir, Clapham Sings, who in our big concert on Tuesday, who when they had been given very specific and repeated instructions to learn all the words, clearly hadn't in the middle of the concert. So their moment of rebellion was looking at me with these wide eyes to say, please mime the words very clearly so we can sing along. So I was proud of the choir in general, but there were some people who could maybe have done a little bit more homework.
We were at a charity carol concert last night for the wonderful charity AdFam, and they had one of those carols. We were all singing alongside the choir where you have very specific instructions.
Yes.
Where the lower voices are going to sing one bit, the higher voices are going to sing the other. There were some first-time church users who just interpreted that as everybody sings, but just in a higher voice or a lower voice. And it did provide some comedy.
Excellent.
Right, it's been so delightful to receive all of your proud as a peacock moments. And blimey, some of you have had such a tough year. And if we could give the prize to everybody, we really, really would. The good news is the competition carries on after Christmas for at least a couple of weeks. So you do have more chances to win the £250 voucher. This just made us laugh because it's the place that we want to be in at the moment in terms of festive moods and stuff. It came in from Joanne the Gardener. My proud achievement for the week is to safely pick up a poo mountain left by an unidentified dog irresponsible owner from the short path leading to my neighbour's house last night before they returned in the dark and walked into it or walked it through their house without knowing. Today's level of rain would have shared it with many others too. It's a weird one, yes, but I haven't told them, but I'm basking in anonymous giver's righteousness. Sending empathetic love to Jane, and PS, to end on a funny note, predictive text changed my first line to good afternoon, fiancé Rosé. And she only just saw it in time. So we will forever have been fiancé Rosé. The winner, though, is going to be Emma. And I will just read straight as it came into our inbox, the email that you sent. I'd like to nominate my husband. Last year before Christmas, we suddenly lost my sister, leaving her 3 children. At the time, we were currently living in a 1-bedroom flat with a baby on the way ourselves. We decided the only place my nieces were going was home with us. So we we took on a really run-down house, which is all our budget allowed. We didn't have a clue about DIY, but since March, my husband has worked every night when he finishes work to get a home perfect for our family, and I am so, so proud of him. Well, there's an element of the Christmas spirit involved in that, isn't there, Emma? So you are a very worthy winner of the £250 Wix voucher. Do carry on sending your proudest moments of the week. You can send them on email to janeandfee@times.radio.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
That is it from us today. Fee will see you in the new year. I'll be back here tomorrow at 5 o'clock in the morning if you are up very early. Don't forget you can get even more of us on your podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee, available wherever you get your podcasts from. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, it is John Pienaar with Drive. Have a very, very happy Christmas. I'll see you tomorrow. Fee, in the new year.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thanks, we thanks Rosie. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. Here is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The Bank of England has cut interest rates to 3.75%, and officials are warning the NHS is nowhere near out of the woods as flu remains at record levels. And coming up, you can hear my interview with the Domestic Abuse Commissioner as we take a close look at the government's strategy to combat violence against women and girls. We're going to be following the talks in Brussels as Europe debates whether to use frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine. And we'll be looking at what it is about festive cookery shows that we just cannot get enough of.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you. The Chancellor says the Bank of England cutting interest rates to 3.75% is welcome news. The quarter percentage point cut was expected after figures yesterday revealed inflation in November fell by more than forecast to 3.2%. The Times' deputy business editor, Tracy Bowles, expects more rate cuts in the coming months.
I reckon they'll keep going next year. So they're now at 3.75%, and I think the city's expecting them to go down to 3, but forecasts do vary quite a lot. The banks moved today because it's confident that inflation's going to come down within the next 6 months to 2%.
The Conservatives say government policy has kept inflation higher than expected. The government might delay local elections for a second year running for millions of people. Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, Hampshire and West Sussex were meant to vote for their councils earlier this year in May, but now may not do so until 2027 because of Labour's shake-up of local councils. Times Radio's Charlie Pritchard explains the reforms.
Labour plans to abolish the two-tier system of county and district councils, instead creating several larger councils covered by a directly elected mayor with extra devolved powers. Ministers will ask Conservative-controlled county councils whether they want to suspend elections in their areas to give them more time to reorganise local government. The decisions come on top of the move to postpone inaugural mayoral elections in the same areas from 2026 to 2028. Any move to delay elections again will prompt anger from Reform and the Liberal Democrats, who have accused Labour of denying democracy.
NHS officials say the health service is not out of the woods yet as the number of flu patients rises again. An average of 3,140 flu patients were in hospital each day last week, up 18% on the week before. That growth rate is slower than earlier in December, though. European leaders are making last-ditch attempts to wear down Belgium's resistance to unlocking a £78 billion loan for Ukraine funded by frozen Russian assets. Without a significant injection of money, Ukraine is projected to run out of money in the coming months. The US is understood to be putting pressure on Europe not to release the Russian funds, arguing that would undermine its peace proposals. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's counting on US support.
They are the decision makers who can really stop Putin. And I count on this. But I really wanted very much them more steps pressuring Russia, because I think that Putin doesn't want to stop this war, but he can if United States will pressure more.
The parents of a teenager from Dunblane in Scotland who took his own life after being blackmailed on Instagram are suing parent company Meta in a case which is believed to be the first of its kind in the UK. 16-year-old Murray Dowie died in 2023 after scammers from West Africa tricked him into sending intimate photos of himself by posing as a teenage girl. Ross and Mark Dowie say Meta knew of safety features which could have helped their son. The company says it has improved protections. And in cricket, England coaches have denied the team are letting captain Ben Stokes down in their must-win third Ashes test. Stokes is the only recognised batsman left for England in the first innings, who are 213 for 8 and trailing Australia by 158 runs after day two. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Could anything be worse than the thought of some teacher standing in front of a classroom of children and teaching them as if it's a normal part of the school day, that it's wrong to sexually abuse women and girls, that girls aren't the playthings of bullying men and boys? Well, maybe one thing is worse than that, the thought of teachers not doing that. No one sane or sensible or ordinarily decent wants innocent children to be schooled in the awfulness of violence and sexual abuse. Problem is, at least it's the government's view now, and how do you disagree, that we have to school our kids in basic, decent, respectful, non-violent behaviour towards women and girls. Abusive behaviour has become frighteningly common. Andrew Tate, with his vile, exploitative and misogynistic online pourings, it's astonishingly popular with young boys. How then to get the teaching right, and how to make the government's election pledge to halve violence against women and girls? How do you fulfil that pledge? I wonder what you are thinking about all that you have heard. Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, on today's show, we're going to be hearing from parents and from teachers. We're going to be hearing from the Victims Commissioner and from the Victims Minister. And hopefully, I'll be hearing from you. Do tell me what you are thinking. And we can start by getting a handle on what the government has now set out in its strategy to combat violence against women and girls with our political editor at Times Radio, Anna Mikhailova. Hi to you, Anna. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Could you just take us through the essence of what the government has set out then?
Sure. So the government has announced its long-awaited strategy on violence against women and girls. And some of the head... I mean, there's a range of measures, including more support in terms of domestic abuse calls, responses, the police. But also the headline measure today that everyone's talking about is the fact that teachers will be asked to give lessons on what's been described as lessons on misogyny to children as young as 11. Mm. So this is what has been leading the both announcement today and also the response from the opposition. And I think there's been a lot of debate about whether or not it's needed. I would point to... So Kemi Badenoch has come out and said that all of this is a complete distraction. And she's accused the government of... having too many people in Labour watching adolescents and sort of doing a knee-jerk reaction. And instead, she says they should be focusing on migration instead, because she says the problem, it's not 11-year-old boys who are committing violence against women and girls, she says. Now, just to take a step back from that and to give the context of this strategy, it's absolutely not true to say that this was being developed because a lot of ministers and the Prime Minister watched adolescents, even though, of course, people did, because all of this was part of the thinking within Labour even before the election. I know it because ministers like Bridget Phillipson, Yvette Cooper were personally very concerned, and specifically with what they were hearing from teachers in the classroom. Mm. So I think there's an element here of some of the political reaction obviously is not that connected to what's going on in schools and what is going on the ground with parents. And also what the government is trying to do here, it says, is to address the root problems and tackle head on something that is a problem in society. I mean, there are many, many examples of that, and take on these reports from teachers that misogyny in schools has got a lot worse, including from a very young age. But of course, there's a lot of debate about whether this approach is the correct approach. It has been notable that there isn't anything on phone use in the strategy. So it's essentially telling teachers to